It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, indigenous people living in North America thousands of years ago were very skilled at domesticating plants. We'll meet a botanist who's been searching high and low for the forgotten crops they left behind. First, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is out after months of speculation that he would either quit or be fired. The news came out in a tweet from President Trump. The president also tweeted that he plans to nominate CIA Director Mike Pompeo as Tillerson's replacement. The relationship between Tillerson and Trump has reportedly had many ups and more downs. Here's the president earlier today.
We got along actually quite well, but we disagreed on things. When you look at the Iran deal, I think it's terrible. I guess he thought it was okay. I wanted to either break it or do something, and he felt a little bit differently. So we were not really thinking the same.
Nehal Tusi is a foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Nehal, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you've been reporting for months on the potential firing of Rex Tillerson. How did it end up happening?
To be honest, it was sort of a surprise. Although people had thought for a long time that Rex Tillerson was going to be on his way out, either getting fired or by quitting, in the last few weeks there was a sense that he'd kind of hit his stride and that he might stick around for longer than people had anticipated. People literally lost bets on this. But, you know, it seems like with the recent revelations involving the talks with North Korea and some other aspects, that President Trump just decided to pull the trigger and replace Mr. Tillerson.
And it doesn't seem like Rex Tillerson was involved in some key Secretary of State type things like this announcement of openness to talking to the head of North Korea, right?
Yeah, I mean, ironically, you know, Tillerson was advocating for talks with North Korea well before Trump was. And so in a way, Trump was coming over to Tillerson's point of view. But when Trump made the final decision, it was very spur of the moment. And he didn't quite loop in the secretary into the decision to actually talk to North Korea. So it was just another example of Tillerson seeming like he was out of the loop and just being caught flat-footed by a very impulsive and mercurial president.
You've been writing about the reaction in the State Department itself. What have sources there been telling you?
Well, you know, when Tillerson came into office, people were really excited. They thought, here's a guy who knows the world, who's run a large organization. They really wanted him to succeed. But over time, they grew incredibly disenchanted with him, and they felt like he was too insular. He'd ignored the expertise at the State Department. He had like a handful of people that he turned to for everything, and people just felt like very frustrated with him. They also didn't like his efforts to cut the staff and to reshape the department and cut the budget. And so there was a lot of unhappiness, and so now people, for the most part, are happy to see him leave. They hope that he takes some of those top aides with him. They really feel very frustrated and angry toward those high-level aides who basically kept Tillerson kind of closeted away, in a sense. And at the same time, they're excited that Pompeo is coming on board because Pompeo has a better relationship with Trump, but they are a little bit worried because Pompeo is much more hawkish than Tillerson and much more of a political partisan.
Tillerson, before his departure, had been vocal about Russia. He put out a statement yesterday condemning Russia for the UK nerve agent attack. The British government blamed Russia. He agreed with that assessment. He also referred to Russia in his sort of parting remarks this afternoon. Here's a listen.
And much work remains to respond to the troubling behavior and actions on the part of the Russian government. Russia must assess carefully as to how its actions are in the best interest of the Russian people and of the world more broadly. Continuing on their current trajectory is likely to lead to greater isolation on their part, a situation which is not in anyone's interest.
Nehal, can you talk about Rex Tillerson and how he's approached Russia versus the rest of the Trump White House?
Well, this is really fascinating because Tillerson was given an award, an order of friendship from Russian President Vladimir Putin several years ago. As the former CEO of ExxonMobil, he knows Putin. He's been to Russia many times. And so a lot of people thought, well, Tillerson's going to be very soft on Russia. Now, in the beginning, Tillerson did try to patch up relations with Russia, and that put him kind of on the same wavelength as President Trump, who came into office keen to make friends with Putin and the Kremlin. That being said, over time, Tillerson has, you know, become more and more frustrated seeing that Russia is not keeping its promises on issues such as Ukraine and Syria. And he has taken a much harder line than the president has. And this past week, just yesterday, it was a very good example. There have been two people poisoned or attacked by some sort of nerve agent in Britain. And the British blame Russia for this attack. And the White House would not go so far as to agree with the British that it was the Russians behind it. But Tillerson did go that far. He called out the Kremlin, and he just, you know, really laid out his frustrations with the Kremlin. And that, once again, seemed to put him at odds with President Trump.
Talking to Nihal Tusi from Politico about the departure of Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. In the how he got fired department, we've heard different stories from the White House and then from a State Department spokesperson, Steve Goldstein, who's been fired since making this statement. He said the secretary had every intention of staying because of the critical progress made in national security. Advancing a bit, the secretary did not speak to the president and is unaware of the reason, but he's grateful for the opportunity to serve. And now he's been fired since this statement. We've heard different accounts of what exactly happened, right?
Yes, that's right. One account says that the chief of staff, John Kelly, told Tillerson on Friday that his ouster was imminent, but that Tillerson didn't realize it was going to be announced in a tweet and that he didn't know this tweet was coming today. Then we've heard Steve Goldstein's account. The funny thing about all this is that in a way, all of this can be true. It is entirely possible that Trump and Tillerson did not speak until this morning, but that Tillerson was aware something was going on as of last week. So it's not necessarily that they are in direct contradiction, but that maybe they tell different pieces of the story. In any case, the White House was deeply frustrated with Steve Goldstein's account, and so they fired him as well. It's been just an extraordinary day, and what's really amazing is that the president this morning, in talking about this, said that he feels like he's finally on the path to where he's getting the cabinet that he wants. And, you know, it's been a year and a half, and almost a year and a half, and that's really extraordinary that he feels like he hasn't quite gotten the cabinet that he wants yet.
You reminded us in a tweet earlier today that Rex Tillerson and Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin reportedly at least had agreed months ago that if the president got rid of one of them, the other two would resign. Have you heard anything about this lately?
No, not at all. And that report from the beginning was very odd because, you know, we can kind of understand Tillerson and Mattis, who are said to be good friends and colleagues, making such an alleged pact. But the Mnuchin factor was a bit odd. People weren't quite sure how Steve Mnuchin, who seems to get along well with Donald Trump, has quite fit into this picture. So, you know, from what we can tell, there's no imminent sense that either Mnuchin or Mattis are going to be leaving. And so I think that report was probably a bit wrong.
Let's look toward the future now. Mike Pompeo will be nominated. The Senate is, I guess, planning on taking up his nomination in April. Well, this North Korea meeting is supposed to happen in what, May? So there's some little chaos at the top of the State Department at a big moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things. One thing we were told is that President Trump wanted a new team in place ahead of these talks, but the confirmation process is going to take a while. Pompeo is a polarizing figure. He's very partisan. A number of human rights groups and Muslim advocacy groups have come out calling him an Islamophobe, saying that, you know, he has not opposed torture. So we can expect these hearings to be pretty intense. And so we don't know when he's going to be confirmed as Secretary of State, or if, I should add. And so, yeah, I mean, we're going to have, you know, Tillerson's going to be gone by the time the North Korea talks happen, if they happen. And it's just more of a vacuum. At the same time, there is an argument to be made that it doesn't really matter because the State Department has been largely sidelined in many of these policy issues, including North Korea, to a large degree. So, you know, a lot of this is going to be run out of the White House anyway.
People have been talking about Tillerson leaving for a long time now. There's speculation about other key people in the national security and foreign policy staff. Nihal, are you expecting to see more firings / resignations anytime soon?
Well, you know, the president said that he's getting close to getting the cabinet that he wants. You know, there's been speculation for weeks, months actually, now that H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor, is also going to be pushed out. So sure. I mean, I think anything is possible. I don't know exactly when it will happen, but, you know, this is an administration that keeps us all on our toes.
Nehal, we'll let you get back to reporting. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nehal Toosey, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. She joined us to look at the shakeup surrounding Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's departure. Right now, when there's no leftover building structures or artifacts to tell us about ancient people who lived in North America, we can learn about their lives by searching for plants that they once used as crops. Natalie Mueller is an archaeologist and ethnobotanist at Cornell University who has spent years hunting for lost crops all over the U.S. Natalie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, can you explain to us, Natalie, what these lost crops are?
So these are a group of several species that were cultivated by ancient people in eastern North America for their seeds in much the same way that we, you know, now cultivate things like corn and wheat.
And so name some of the names. What kind of plants are you hunting for?
Sure. So some of these will be familiar to gardeners and farmers because they're commonly thought of as weeds. So the most common one is goosefoot. Its Latin name is Chenopodium. And that one, any farmer will definitely have seen in their field. And then another one of our lost crops is a plant called knotweed, which is in the genus Pugnum. That's also a really common weed. So during the summertime, pretty much anywhere in the eastern U.S., you can go and find members of this genus growing in a sidewalk, which is a nice little parlor trick for me when I'm explaining this to people. And then there's another one that's common name is marsh elder, which is a plant that grows in marshy and swampy environments. And then we have two little grasses that are going to be coming up pretty soon, spring maturing grasses called maygrass and little barley.
And part of what you do, and this is pretty amazing, some of these aren't as common and they're not popping up in farms, and you go on expeditions to likely places around the country and just go searching through the woods or swamp or caves trying to find the modern descendants of these crops, right?
Yeah, that's right. So for the past few years, I've been going out every spring and fall on collecting trips to try and document as many places where these species occur as I can, and also to collect seeds, because what I'm doing at Cornell is actually growing them experimentally to try and reconstruct how this agricultural system would have worked.
So tell us about the rise and fall of these plants. I guess these were people farming. They domesticated these, and since they stopped domesticating them, they've gone wild again?
Yeah, that's right. So beginning around 4,000 years ago, ancient Native Americans started to domesticate certain plants. And actually one of the earliest domesticates was sunflower, which, of course, we still grow today. So that's not a lost crop. That's a, you know, remaining crop. And then some of these other ones that I just mentioned, people started cultivating soon after that, around 4,000 years ago. And they were really important crops right up until around 1,000 AD of the Common Era. And that's about the same time that maize, or what we usually call corn in the U.S., arrived. So that originated in Mexico, and as we know, it's a really productive, really amazing crop. And so gradually people started to grow that more and more, and the older crops kind of started to fall by the wayside. So nowadays, they're growing as most of them are sort of weedy plants, where they grow in disturbed locations or near agricultural fields and things like that. And we really don't know if they're completely wild plants, or some of them may have been, you know, descended from the earlier cultivated population.
So given that we don't have written records or pictures, how do we know that these were plants that were cultivated as food crops, say, 2,000-3,000 years ago?
Oh, we have lots of different kinds of archaeological evidence. And archaeologists started to find evidence for these lost crops in the 1960s. And, some of it we found in normal sort of archaeological context, like storage pits and cooking hearths. We'll find the seeds in places like that, sometimes in dense concentrations of, you know, up to hundreds of thousands of seeds of one of these plants in a storage pit. We've also found them in certain really good conditions in caves where there's dry conditions. We'll actually find baskets or bags that are full of the seeds of these plants, which is pretty cool. And then my personal favorite form of evidence is actually ancient human poop from dry caves, which archaeobotanists have dissected. And inside of these poops, we found the seeds of these plants. So it's sort of the smoking gun that shows us that people are eating these.
And I learned from reading about your work, a domesticated plant looks a lot different than its wild cousins, I guess, or descendants in this case. So what changes?
There's a few things that have changed with most of our wild plants that we grow for their seeds. And the biggest thing is that their seeds get larger. So that isn't just because people prefer larger seeds because you get more food from them. It's also because of selection that happens when we garden. So if there's any gardeners listening, you probably go through and thin out your seedlings a few weeks after you plant your seeds so that you don't have plants competing with each other too much. What that does is it selects for seeds that germinate and grow faster, and usually those are the bigger seeds. And it also selects for seeds that will germinate reliably. So wild plants oftentimes need certain conditions to be met in order to germinate, so they need to experience cold weather or soil moisture or pass through the digestive tract of an animal, but our domesticated plants will germinate as soon as they're planted.
Talking to Natalie Mueller from Cornell University about lost crops. These are things that were cultivated by indigenous people in North America. We're talking 1,000, 2,000 plus years ago. Not cultivated anymore. She is hunting for their wild descendants. We've got a caller, actually, Bill in Oregon. Bill, hi.
Hi, yeah. I'm a farmer. I grow aronia, also known as chokeberry, and I heard that the Native Americans used it as a medicinal crop. Do you have any findings on aronia?
Natalie, aronia or... go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, is aronia or chokeberry on your list of crops of interest?
So it's not within my study area, but I've definitely read about it in, you know, studies of the ethnobotany of the Northwest Coast. It's a really interesting plant, but as far as I know, it's not as important in the eastern U.S.
Thanks a lot for the call, Bill. So how do you figure out where, especially for the more elusive wild plants that you're looking at, how do you know where to start looking?
One resource that I use a lot are what are called herbaria, or the singular herbarium. And basically what these are is they're like libraries, but instead of having books, they have pressed plant specimens, which in some cases go back hundreds of years. And a lot of times there'll be very detailed information about where those specimens were collected. So I use that information to go back and revisit areas where these plants were growing in the past. And at first I was just kind of doing that because it was a convenient way to try and find them. But it also has the added benefit, or it's interesting because then you can see how the distribution of these plants has changed over time. And, of course, in the past, you know, 300 years, there have been huge changes in the way that we use the landscape in this country. So many of the populations of these plants that used to exist are now gone.
And some of the plants you are studying and hunting for, I understand, are endangered now. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm the only one studying them, so I guess you'll just have to take my word for it. But the one species that I wrote my dissertation about, which is called erect knotweed, as I said, its close relatives are extremely common, but those are species that were introduced, or invasive species from Eurasia. And the native species is unable to compete with these in urban environments because it's less tolerant of being mowed with lawnmowers. And so it's disappearing from those landscapes where it used to be really common.
Reading your blog and just reading about how you are out there hunting, it seems like, you know, you almost have Indiana Jones moments where you find this holy grail you've been looking for. What does it feel like when you've stumbled on one of these hard-to-find plants?
Well, in the case for erect knotweed, it felt pretty good because if I hadn't found it, my dissertation would have been sort of endangered. So, yeah, that was I was lucky to find that on, you know, some of the places that I've had success finding that are actually on private property. And oftentimes organic farmers, like my friend who's sort of taking care of the population that I talk about on my blog, will have the more rare weeds and things on their farms because they don't use as many chemical herbicides and things like that. So that's been a really, you know, cool place where I found a lot of those. And then it's also... The other one that I've talked about on my blog is this grass, maygrass, which is doing okay in protected sort of prairie environments, but it used to be really common along agricultural fields. And again, with the increased spraying of herbicides, it's now kind of uncommon to find a large stand of it. So it's pretty exciting when we do track one down.
I got to ask, these are plants that people were eating, you know, the ancestors of these plants a millennium ago, two millennia ago. Have you been able to eat any of these?
And I always get that question. And unfortunately, I haven't really been able to eat them much yet because for the past 2 years, I've just been trying to get enough seed so that, you know, I make sure I have enough for my experiments every year. But I'm hoping that after this year, I'll have plenty of seeds to do a bunch of really large-scale cooking experiments and figure out the best way to prepare these things.
And are you recruiting people to keep an eye out on their property or when they're out in nature to try to spot some of these plants for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I also am working with a number of colleagues on this who are studying the lost crops in their own particular ways. So you can get information from the website that one of my colleagues at Ohio University has made called lostcrops.org. And if you want to kind of communicate with us about, if you think you have some of them growing on your property, or if you want us to send you some seeds so that you can try and grow them yourself, that's a good way to kind of get in touch.
And now spring's almost here, here and I guess where you are too. I mean, is this going to be prime hunting season for you coming up?
Yeah, for two of the lost crops, for maygrass and little barley, it is. So if they're, you know, plant-savvy people listening, they're probably thinking, well, little barley is not particularly difficult to find. It's literally everywhere. So I'll collect that sort of expediently wherever I see it. But I'll probably be making a trip down to Arkansas and Mississippi to collect seeds for maygrass in a couple months.
All right, Natalie, happy hunting, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Natalie Mueller, an archaeologist and ethnobotanist at Cornell University who spent a year hunting for lost crops all over the eastern part of the United States. First, a new study released by researchers at MIT paints a bleak picture of how truth tends to lose ground to fake news and misleading information on social media. The researchers looked at nearly 126,000 stories shared over the last decade by more than 3 million English-speaking users on Twitter. Over the course of the study, they found that false information was shared widely and quickly as compared to correct information. Our next guest is here to talk about the impact that fake news can have on American political discussions. Mike Wagner is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, and he's an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. He blogs at prowag.me. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Well, what do you make of this study and what we're learning from it?
Well, it's very thorough. It looked at tweets over a decade-long period and was very carefully done. And so I think we need to take the results really seriously. It shows, you know, the old saying that a lie gets halfway around the world while the truth is putting its pants on is true. It's much more likely that information that is not true spreads more quickly and to more people than true information does, which should give us pause in a democratic republic like ours.
And this looked at what we might call fake news, but other forms of rumors and misleading information.
Right.
I mean, do we want to lock down the fake news term, first of all, as we're talking about it today? What do we mean when we say that?
Well, I think by fake news, we mean, at least I mean, things that are reported by a source that says they're a news source that is where that information is not true. And, you know, ideally what we would like to know is that they knew it was not true and reported it anyway. That's, you know, the kind of the purest kind of fake news. But there are lots of different definitions. The president's definition is things I don't agree with, which is not a very good definition. But, you know, news that is not accurate, does not hold up to scrutiny, has been debunked, fact-checked, that those sorts of things all would fall under the rubric, I think.
This MIT study, people are saying, is in many ways the biggest study of the spread of misinformation. Is there a growing interest in trying to come to grips with how information, bad information, spreads on social media?
That is a part of a sea change in the study of political communication. I mean, even here at UW-Madison, our social media and democracy team in our department is looking at that with the tweets we've been harvesting every day for 6 or 7 years, finding these messages spreading in the same way. In one study led by Josephine Lukido, a graduate student in our department, and Chris Wells, a professor, found that news organizations will actually use tweets that were produced by bots in their stories as examples of American public opinion, when in fact they're Russian bots, pretending to say things to advance some kind of line of argument in a story, and almost every major American news outlet does it, not by design, but by being fooled by these tweets.
Right. There's that vox pop idea, as we call it, vox populi. What are people saying about this?
Right.
An easy way for a media person is, well, let's find what people are saying on Twitter, but often the people aren't people.
Right. You know, in any intro to journalism class, professors like me have students go out and do a person on the street story. You know, go interview 10 people and find out what they think about this issue. And now it's easy to do that on social media. And lots of news organizations will just show screenshots of tweets to say, here's what people are saying. You know, like the Today Show does this every morning. They take some question and they show tweets. Well, what Josephine Liquido and Chris Wells found was that real news organizations are posting tweets that were created by Russian bots and using them as examples of American public opinion. And so it's easy to fool people on Twitter into thinking that they're American citizens expressing their views when they're not.
So if in some cases even the media pros are getting fooled by a fake, maybe it's not fake news exactly, but opinions from fake people, what's the average person supposed to do as they go through their Twitter feed or Facebook feed or whatever?
It's extraordinarily difficult. But what I would say are the two things to look for, which also happen to be the two biggest predictors of sharing things that aren't true on social media, are, is there a lot of emotional language in that tweet or in that Facebook post? If so, it's probably more likely to get shared, but it also might be more likely not to be real. And the second is, how novel is it? We tend to share things that are novel. When we share things that are novel, it's the case that if there's only one organization saying that, we should be skeptical as to whether or not that's actually true. And so novelty and emotionality are things we should say, oh, should I share this? Maybe it's not true. Maybe I should see if there's another source that makes this same claim.
Talking to Mike Wagner from UW-Madison, looking at the spread of false information online on social media. Big news study from MIT finding that fake news and false information can spread very quickly as compared to the real stuff. And Mike, I've been in that situation myself. This story, if this were true, every media source in the world would be talking about it, or at least half of them. And then you go and you can only find other news sources you've never heard of until that moment.
Right. If every source you find is a place you haven't heard of, you should be extremely skeptical that that statement is true or that story is true. Maybe 1 out of 100 might end up being true, but you'll save yourself a lot of grief and a lot of embarrassment if you don't share that story until you find it from a source you trust.
Did this MIT study try to get into the impact of the spread of this false information?
It's really difficult to understand the impact, right? So on the one hand, false information is more likely to get shared. It gets shared very quickly. When true information is shared, it is not shared as quickly or as far. Even the retweet chains, right? So false news gets retweeted more than real news gets retweeted because real news isn't as novel or as emotional typically. And so the impact of that is really challenging. On the one hand, we know from fact-checking research that a lot of people, when they see the corrective story, to say, oh, this thing really isn't true, if the correction makes you reconsider a prior belief, it's really hard to actually accept the truth. And so we tend to fall back on our prior beliefs, even if we're told in a fact check that that's not true. So the impact of this stuff can be huge. There are times when fact checks are effective and can change our attitudes, but it's very difficult to do, and it's very difficult to get the facts to spread in a way that are interpreted in a kind of a uniform way across the public.
Right. Let's just say a fake news story A is making the rounds and some fact checker comes across it and fact checks.
Well, actually, A is false. Right.
Yeah. But if the same group of people aren't retweeting or forwarding that fact check, so what?
Right. If they're not sharing that information, that's a problem. And then if the people who believed it when it was wrong the first time don't update their beliefs to what's true, then there's a deleterious effect of the sharing of this false information. And so some of the questions that scholars like me now need to be asking ourselves is, when this news spreads, is it persuading people that that information is true or not? Or is it just fun to share? Or is it, or do we share stuff that confirms what we already believe? And if we already believe it, then it's not the fake news that's the problem. It's the beliefs that we hold that might be the problem. And so the scale of this problem is really hard to wrap our hands around, I think.
And a reaction I've seen sometimes when I've seen false information spreading online is, why isn't media source X reporting on this? Well, they're not, because it's not actually a thing, but actually for people who already have a credibility problem with a particular media source, the false information actually reinforces that.
It really does, and it puts the news media, who are doing legitimate work, in a really tough position, because the fact-checking research suggests if you want to persuade people of the truth, don't repeat the falsehood in the process of telling the truth. Don't say false claim A is false. Just say the truth instead. But if journalists don't do it in that way, then you, as you point out, these naysayers will say, well, why aren't they reporting on the story that I'm seeing all over my feed from people I trust?
How have you seen this develop since the beginning of social media? Is this kind of an exponential growth in bad information, or has it been there since the start?
People have always spread false stories.
Before the internet.
The internet did not invent the spreading of rumors. But the exponential nature with which it grows, the networks that the false information can get into, and the staying power of that false information, I think, is fundamentally different than it was when I was growing up.
Are people doing network mapping, finding out source A says this, then it spreads to B, and B, well, 100 people re-forward that or whatever. Are we getting maps of how these things spread?
We are, and, you know, we can map all kinds of information, whether it's the spread of fake news or just the spread of political news, the spread of sports information. You know, the work we're doing at Wisconsin, it kind of creates some of these maps, and we can tell. So there's some node where these tweets begin, and then their follower networks retweet, and then their follower networks retweet, and we can kind of map out how that works geographically, how that matters politically. People tend to retweet in their own kind of political networks when it's news about politics. They tend not to retweet stuff from the other side, for example. And so we can map with some precision how this stuff works.
But it's got to be a moving target, because if I'm someone who is motivated, if I'm trying to spread particular information, true or false, I'm going to be trying to figure out the same things and then maximize those networks to spread it even faster.
Right. And the goals of the researchers to make these maps might be different, and probably are different, than the goals of the people spreading the fake information. We can't know as scholars which networks they're trying to infiltrate. We can guess based on probabilities of, well, if you wanted to win an election, you might try to target these voters with fake information about that candidate. But it's really hard to know what the motives are, other than just spreading chaos and making it more difficult to understand what's true. And if that's the goal, in some ways it's succeeding. It's increasingly difficult for a regular person living their life to say, I just heard this new thing. Now, how do I decide and how do I know whether to judge whether this is true?
We're talking to Mike Wagner. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you are on social media, have you run into stories maybe shared by a friend or family member that you knew to be false or discovered later was not true? Do you source check? Do you go back and try to figure out if things are true when they pop up on whichever social media feed you're looking at? Have you ever shared a story and then found out it, well, wasn't true after all? Did you try to do damage control there? And what impact does all this false information and fake news have on American culture and politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with Mike Wagner about a new study looking at the spread of fake news and false information on social media. Mike's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the spread of misleading information, false rumors, fake news on social media? Do you run into it a lot on your own social media feeds? Has it started arguments with your friends, family, acquaintances, or former friends and acquaintances? Call in at 800-642-1234. And do you think social media platforms have a responsibility to try to slow the spread of misleading information? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to our callers now. Camille is with us in New Berlin. Camille, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question. I'll take my answer off the air. I was wondering, as you studied these fake news postings, whether or not there seemed to be a trend, or were they divided completely, more or less equally down the middle? Did these postings lean to the left or lean to the right more so in the fake news category?
Camille, thanks for the call. I've definitely seen both, Mike, but is there any sort of quantitative study that says, hey, it's more one side or the other?
Yeah, the MIT study that we're talking about, I don't know that it weighs in directly on this. There's other research that suggests there are asymmetries in the spreading of false information from the left and the right. And the question is whether it's that the right spreads things that aren't true more, or it's that the group that is out of power spreads things that aren't true more. And so there's evidence in terms of belief of conspiracy theories that conservatives are more likely to believe in some conspiracy theories about President Obama. And after President Trump was elected, liberals became more likely to endorse some conspiracy theories. And so some of this is a human enterprise, but some of this is a result of asymmetries in information. And Russia and the work that people producing bots for Russia on Twitter and Facebook did sow fake news across the ideological spectrum, but waited to fake news that would serve conservative candidates. Whether that kind of thing would continue, I think, is an open question, and whether their goal to kind of foment a more chaotic way with which we come to understand what the truth is as a public is still something that remains to be seen.
Camille, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Rebecca with us in West Allis. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. I had a comment. I had a couple of cousins and their whole group of friends were spreading some news story on a website called where they had vaccines causing autism is now listed on the label, and the FDA is actually coming out and is admitting it. And of course, I'm trying to like fact check. I'm like, no, it's not. Here's Snopes. Here's a couple of other articles saying like, no, you're wrong. And you know, I got blamed as, you know, being the one trying to cause problems. And there's a little schism going on. And it's like, no, well, my daughter's fully vaccinated. She's fine. It doesn't cause autism. And you know, they're like, oh no, you're a lucky one.
Rebecca, thanks for that call. So, yeah, there is the risk if you try to correct any false information that, well, you're one of them.
That story is a really common story that I find is in kind of studying the information environment, is when people engage with their friends and family, they start, you know, family fights that go beyond the political disagreement to get into the what actually happens in people's social lives. And we've seen that happen in Wisconsin in a lot of different ways over the last decade, of where the politics has become the personal. And correcting that information, it is a bold choice to do, because you're putting yourself out there and you're asserting something is true. In that case, you know, the caller is in the right. You know, vaccines have not been shown to cause autism, and the one study that suggested there might be a link was debunked, and the person who authored it lost their medical license. And so it's certainly the case that it's really hard to make these corrections, because people become deeply committed to their beliefs. And if they want to believe something to be true about the president or a political enemy or a health behavior, it's really hard to help people overcome those misinformation, those false beliefs.
Rebecca, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234, talking about the spread of false information and fake news and rumors on social media. Mike Wagner is with us from UW-Madison. And Mike, I'll ask you a question that I throw out to the listeners there. Does a social media company, a provider, a Twitter, a Facebook, whatever, have a responsibility to police this, to try to change things?
I think it's worth the work for a company like Facebook or Twitter to think about how information gets shared on their site. And Facebook has been thinking a lot about this and has announced some changes, kind of trying to move toward more interactive experiences rather than the sharing kind of thing that caused a lot of fomented sharing of things that weren't true, say during the 2016 election. And so, they're making efforts. They're not always making efforts that coincide with what research would suggest would help the most, but they are making efforts to deal with these kinds of problems. But it's also a very thorny issue. It's a country of free speech, and some things that aren't true or that we don't think are true now, we may learn later are true. And so it's very difficult to know what those things are and what's the balance of if one out of every 100 things ends up being true, even though it's not likely to be true, is that worth it to have that imbalance? Those are really big questions that these kinds of companies have to grapple with.
Well, and I always come back to the metaphor of what a social media platform is. Is it like a newspaper where it has a responsibility to confirm things that are stated on it, or is it the phone company? It doesn't care what we say to each other on the phone.
Right. I mean, it's certainly not a newspaper, and it's certainly not the phone. It's somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. But Facebook doesn't pay me to share bits of information that I want to share on my Facebook page, and so I'm not an employee of them. And so to make it that they would have to confirm the things that I say puts a really difficult burden on them. But if I'm sharing things that fundamentally aren't true and could have wide-ranging consequences for how our country operates, it's something that even if there's not a legal requirement for Facebook to do something about it, this is probably an ethical one.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My concerning issue in regards to a lot of false narratives and half-truths, it's been going on for decades. I'm sure everybody can remember watching a 10-minute commercial during election season tossing out some false narratives and or truths against one another's opponent. What's more concerning to me these days is that nobody's taking the time out anymore to actually do a little research on seeing whether or not what that person is saying is true, or get the full story. I have kids that are age 21 down to 17, and it seems to me that anything you read on social media is almost to the point of like the gospel truth, and it's a little discerning. And you never really get them to start opening up until they bring it up into a conversation. And then as a parent, I have to let them know, hey, you need to do a little bit more research.
Jeremy, thanks. I'm going to jump in because we're a little short on time. But what do you think, Mike?
Well, I think it's great that he's, reminding his children, look, when you hear a claim, it's really important to try to figure out or suss out whether that claim is true. It's difficult, right? Most people don't wake up thinking, well, how am I going to hold my government accountable today? That's just, we have to do the laundry and go to work and deal with the kids and their homework projects, and we have to, get groceries and all that stuff. And yet, we also have to make choices about who we want to represent us in our Republican democracy. And to do that, we ought to know something about what's happening in the world. And to know something about what's happening in the world, we ought to be able to judge what is true and what isn't, which requires us, I think, to take that extra step. If the information we're seeing is really emotional or really provocative, we should make sure someone else is saying it, a place that we've heard of, a source that we trust, before we share that and say that that's what's true.
As we wrap up, Mike, this is pretty important, right? Because I keep seeing studies about how more and more people are turning to their social media feeds as a main source of their news.
It's really important. And another study done by some of the students in our graduate program at Wisconsin, Emily Vraga led the project, found is that it's really hard for people to remember where they learned stuff. And so we have to be good judges of what might be accurate, because once we think we know it, we'll forget if we learned it from, World News Daily or The New York Times or The Wall Street Journal.
Mike, as we wrap up, is the flow of false information going to slow down anytime soon?
Nope.
Good place to leave it. Yeah. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Mike Wagner. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He's an affiliate of the Elections Research Center, and he blogs at prowag.me. He joined us today to talk about a new MIT study looking at the spread of fake news and false information, especially on social media. This study focused on Twitter. Well, you can let us know what you think via Twitter. You could tweet us at Central Time WPR. And of course, you can email ideas@WPR.org. If you have a story to share, as some of our callers did, of fact-checking something you saw on social media or encouraging others to fact-check themselves, please share that with us. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Last week on the show, we talked about Wisconsin bands performing at the South by Southwest Music Festival this week, and we talked about Wisconsin cheese in a big international cheese contest. Today, it's a mashup. Wisconsin Cheese is performing at South by Southwest. Central Time Cheese Man Dean Kinetter is back. Dean, tell us about this giant cheese board.
Well, the jury is still out on whether this is a table or a cheese board, but regardless, it looks beautiful. This thing is 70 feet long.
70 feet of Wisconsin cheese.
That's right. And even if you conservatively estimate a foot and a half per cheese, you're not going to leave hungry.
And this is the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board, the cheese people here in Wisconsin. You were looking at some pictures earlier. Did you see what kind of cheeses are represented?
I could pick out a few of them, yeah. We've got Widmer's Aged Brick. That's an old-school, funky, washed rind cheese. We've got Dunbarton Blue from cheesemaker Chris Rowley, a style that he just decided to invent one day. Roth's Grand Cru Sur Choix. And Hook's has a blue cheese there called You Have to Be Kidding Me, made with sheep, cow, and goat milk.
And you were at the big international cheese contest last week, and you ate a lot of cheese. Do you still have a cheese hangover, or if you were at this 70-foot cheese board, would you be sampling?
I will be there, whether it's a table, board, bucket, kettle. Give me the cheese.
You cannot over-cheese Dean Kinetter. Dean, thanks a lot.
You bet.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.